Jack cut the thread and handed back the mended coat. He looked out of the window where the Shannon's topsails winked in the evening light and said,
"Dear Lord above, how I do wish I could set you clear of all this dirty, ugly, underhanded mess. How I long for the open sea!"
The dawn of Sunday did not break at all. The fog that had formed in the night only became a little lighter and more visible as it moved in quiet swathes along the quays, sometimes making silent whirlpools at the street corners where it met a current of air. The slight increase in light was not enough to wake Dr. Maturin, however, and the two nurses with whom he had contracted to go to early mass were obliged to beat on his door to rouse him. He hurried into his clothes, but even so the priest was on the altar by the time they reached the obscure chapel in a side alley, and crept into the immensely evocative smell of old incense. There followed an interval on a completely different plane of being, with the familiar, ancient words around him always the same, in whatever country he had ever been, though now uttered in a broad Munster Latin. He lived free of time or geography, and he might have walked out, a boy, into the streets of Barcelona, blazing white in the sun, or into those of Dublin under the soft rain. He prayed, as he had prayed so long for Diana. But even before the priest dismissed them, the changed nature of his inner words brought him back to the immediate present and to Boston, and if he had been a weeping man, it would have brought the tears coursing down his face. As it was, he felt a dry burning in his eyes, a constriction in his throat, while he waited for the priest to come out of the vestry. To him he stated that he was a prisoner of war, that he was likely to be exchanged in the next few days, that he wished to be married before his voyage, and that as soon as he could he would acquaint Father Costello with the day and hour, because the ceremony would have to be carried out with very little notice. Then he left the misty, candle-lit chapel for the colder fog outside, and considered for a while. It would be no use calling on Diana at this time of the morning, since she often lay abed till noon. But there were many other things to do. Perhaps the first should be to see Mr. Andrews, the British agent for prisoners of war. Stephen knew where he lived, and taking his bearings from the vague form of a clock tower, he set out. He had a fair knowledge of the town, and he was confident that presently he should cross the street with Franchon's hotel in it. The agent's house lay not far from the hotel, a couple of hundred yards behind it. But the broad street did not appear. Instead he found himself at the harbour, with a far broader sea at his feet, stretching away into the greyness. High water, and scarcely a ripple. The wet quays were empty. Drops fell from the yards and rigging of the ships tied up along them. No sound but the clopping of a few horses' hooves, and the distant plash of oars, as those few Bostonians who celebrated the Sabbath on Saturday, or who did not celebrate it at all, rowed out to go fishing. On ordinary days there were a good many of these small craft. The Shannon never troubled them at all, but had been seen purchasing their lobsters, pollock, hake, and halibut in baskets. At last he found a negro on the waterfront, but the negro was a stranger in those parts, and together they wandered in search of the street that ran down and opened onto the harbour itself. No street. Only vile cobbles, puddles, dark warehouses, and the encircling fog, and at one point Stephen thought they must soon reach the open country. But in time a light appeared, a row of lighted windows. "Let us knock," he said, "and ask our way. We may be out of the town entirely." Yet before he had had time to knock, he found he knew the place. Although the fog removed it from its context and altered its perspective, it was the tavern where he had met Mr. Hedipath and his friends. The place was open, and as he pushed the door, a rectangular flood of orange light lit up the fog. "Come in and drink a cup of coffee, friend," he said to his companion.
"But I am a negro, sir."
"A black man," said he.
"It is no very heinous crime."
"Oh, brother, you sure stranger here?" said the negro, laughing. And he vanished into the fog, laughing still. When Stephen came out, wiping his lips, it had thinned somewhat, and at times the red ball of the sun could be seen. The geography, at least, was plain. He walked briskly along to what he privately called the Rambler, and up it to the hotel. There was some activity within, but as far as he could make out, Diana's windows were blind. No lights behind the balcony along the whole first floor. From the hotel he took first one side street, where a disoriented cock was crowing, then another, peopled by ghostly hogs, and not by hogs alone. He passed a couple of men lounging in a doorway, and an interminable family carrying prayer books, and as he drew near to Mr. Andrews's house, he saw a vague, dark shape that very soon resolved itself into a coach, four horses stretching out before it, gently steaming through their cloths. A black coach. Pontécanet's coach. No light in Andrews's windows, none in the fanlight of his door. Deliberately he began to cross the road, but a head at the coach window cried, "Le voilà!" The doors opened, and men poured out. Stephen whipped round and raced back. A hog across his path very nearly brought him down, and as he recovered, he heard a whistle blown behind him and saw the two men leave their doorway. They ran to close the two side alleys, and both had their pistols out. The numerous family lay between him and them. Did they amount to a crowd? A group numerous enough? They did not. Stephen was among them, the woman's outraged face turning towards him as he jostled her tallest boys, but even so the man on the left levelled his piece and fired, hitting a child just by him. After an infinitesimal pause of stupor, the man of the family went for him like a tiger with his stick, and Stephen ran left-handed past the fighting pair. The streaming hogs, the screaming children delayed the man on the right and those from the coach. Stephen had a clear start, but he also had a shocking stitch in his side. As he laboured on, he looked right and left for a lighted house, a church, a tavern, and looked in vain, for this was a commercial district, gaunt warehouses with cranes protruding from their upper stories, closed offices, shut up shops, and the running feet were louder and louder behind. A weed-grown vacant lot, an improvised pigsty within it, he slipped through the ragged palings and crouched there with a gravid sow near her time, timid and new-littered for her farrowing. Bent double to overcome the stitch, he stared round for the dwelling of the man who had brought the straw. No cottage, no dwelling-house at all, only stark walls soaring up on all three sides, and no way out. In a few moments, when they missed him ahead, his refuge would become a hopeless trap, and the fog was growing patchy as a small breeze wafted it to and fro. The stitch was gone. He moved to the paling, but already here were two men running back. He shrank down among the nettles, his pistol in his hand, a very wicked look on his face. They passed. He slipped out and ran directly after them, going free and fine, a bounding step. He passed a barefoot, staring boy. The corner could not be far. But there were running steps, a single man behind, and though now he ran at his greatest speed, even at the risk of overtaking those in front, the steps ran faster still. Closer, closer, and he could hear the panting breath. He could feel the pointing pistol. Closer still, and the man was abreast, an Indian, a half-caste glancing sideways, a questioning dark face he had never seen, and here was the corner showing through the fog.
"Vite! Vite!" cried Stephen in a gasping croak. "À gauche! Tu l'attraperas!"
The man nodded, sped on, turned the corner at a shocking speed. The fog swallowed him. Stephen bore right and left, and here was the coach again. Still no light in Andrews's house, and cries behind him and in front, for one group had made the whole circuit. The coach doors still hung open, not a man there, but the driver, dim in his box. Calling out,
"Allez, allez!"
Stephen ran to the coach, slammed the near door, sprang onto the box, clapped his cocked pistol to the coachman's head, and said,
"Fouet!"
The coachman changed colour, gathered his reins, cried,
"Ray!"
and cracked his whip. The horses lunged forward. The coach moved off, faster, faster and faster.
"Fouet! Fouet!" said Stephen,
and the coachman plied his whip. The first group of men, tall Pontécanet with him, appeared ahead, stringing out across the road as they grasped the situation.
"Fouet toujours!"
said Stephen, grinding the pistol into the coachman's neck. They drove straight through the line, and here was the side road that led to the broad main street.
"À gauche! À gauche, je te dis!"
The coachman reined in to take the corner. The pursuers gained. The coach was round, rocking wildly on its springs. The broad street was just ahead.
"À droite!"
said Stephen, for the right-hand turn would take them fast away, galloping down the good road to the harbour. The coachman half stood to heave upon the reins and swing his horses round. The pistol shifted as Stephen braced himself for the turn, and with a furious heave of his loins, the coachman jerked him off. He was up like a cat before the coachman could stop his team, before Pontécanet and his men were more than a vague, dark mass coming towards him. He ran up the street, away from the coach, but he could not run much more. His head had hit the curb, and his feet were straying wild. And there was shouting in the fog ahead. Here was Franchon's hotel, and here, better than any public door with a Frenchman so hot for blood, was the workmen's rope, dangling from the balcony. Hand over hand he went up it, and not indeed like a topman laying aloft, but like a lithe, dangerous, wild beast, trying one last ruse before turning on its equally dangerous and more numerous enemies. The balcony railing, and he was over, crouching there with his breath coming in enormous gasps, his heart beating as though it filled his breast, his eyes unable to focus clear. He heard French voices below arguing about the way to take.
"He may have gone in here!"
It would not be long before they saw the rope. His breath was coming easier now, and he could see. He crept fast and low along the balcony, counting the windows to Diana's room. Hers was closed, and shuttered too. He rapped. No reply. He whipped out his catling, slid the blade into the crack, and raised the bar, opened the shutter, tapped on the glass. A voice below.
"I shall climb it."
"Diana!"
he called, and he saw her sit up in bed.
"Quick! For the love of God!"
The rope was creaking behind him now.
"Who is it? Don't be a fool, woman!"
he called, low but sharp, through the small gap he had forced in the frame. A broken pane would be sheer disaster.
"Open, quick, dear Christ and all!"
She sprang up, opened the long window. He slid the shutter to without a sound, closed the window behind him, drew the curtain, and leapt into her bed. A huge bed, and he at the bottom of it.
"Get in on top of me,"
he whispered through the sheets.
"Ruffle the clothes upon its foot."
She sat there rigid, her toes warm upon his neck. Quiet footsteps on the balcony.
"No, that is Johnson's woman's room. Try the next but two."
A long, silent pause, and at last a knock on the door. Madame Franchon's voice. She was extremely sorry to disturb Mrs. Villiers, but it was thought that a thief had taken refuge in the hotel. Had Mrs. Villiers heard or seen anything? "No," said Diana, "nothing at all." Might Madame Franchon look at the inner rooms? Mrs. Villiers had the keys.
"Certainly," said Diana. "Wait a moment."
She slipped out of bed, threw some gauzy things over it, opened the door, and returned to the deep, rumpled nest of eiderdown and countless pillows.
"The keys are on the table there," she said.
It took Madame Franchon only a few minutes to decide that the inner rooms, with their closed, unbroken windows and their unviolated doors, contained no flying thief, but in that time Stephen thought he must die of cramp and suffocation. The worst was the flood of apologies, and he felt an infinite relief when Diana cut them short, closed the door on Madame Franchon, and shot the bolt. He came out into the air, and gradually the drumming in his ears died away.
"You should have a drink, Maturin,"
she whispered, reaching for a pretty little decanter by her bed.
"You don't mind drinking out of my glass?"
She poured him a stiff tot, and mechanically he drank it off. The fire spread in his vitals. He recognized the smell, the same smell that mingled with Diana's usual scent there in the bed.
"Is it a kind of whiskey?"
he asked.
"They call it bourbon," she said. "Another drop?"
Stephen shook his head.
"Is your maid here? The tall one, Peg. Send her away, right away, until tomorrow."
Diana went into another room. He heard the distant ringing of a bell, and then Diana's voice, telling Peg to take Abijah and Sam to Mr. Adams's house in the dog-cart, and to give him this note. Well, there seemed to be some low, murmuring objection, for Diana's voice rose to a sharp, imperious tone, and the door closed with a decided clap. She came back and sat on the side of the bed.
"That's done," she said. "I have sent them all off until Monday morning."
She looked at him affectionately, hesitated, poured herself a finger of bourbon, and said,
"What are you at, Maturin? Flying from an angry husband? It is not like you to bound from one bed to another. Yet after all you are a man. You spoke to me from the other side of the window just like a man, just as though we were already married. You called me a fool. But perhaps I am a fool. I was truly desolated hearing you with Johnson yesterday, and not seeing you after all. My God, Stephen, I was so glad to hear your voice just now. I thought you had deserted me."
He turned his face to her, and her smile faded. He said,
"I was escaping from Ponticane and his band. They mean to kill me if they can. They waylaid me in the street yesterday. That was what I was speaking to Johnson about, and they made a far more determined attempt just now. Listen, honey, will you dress at once and go to the British agent? Tell him I am beset and cannot stir from here. Ponticane and Dubreuil live in this hotel, do they not?"
"Yes."
"Any others?"
"No, but all the Frenchmen, officers and civilians, haunt the place. There are always half a dozen of them in the hall."
"Sure, I saw them myself. Now Andrews may not be in Boston on a Sunday. There was no light in his house this morning, but he has a cottage by the sea somewhere this side of Salem. Herapath knows it. He has been there. Could you see Herapath without Wogan?"
"Very easily. Louisa is in the country with Johnson."
"Ah, then if Andrews is not here, take Herapath with you to the cottage. Tell Andrews that if he can gather a party of our officers to cover us, all will be well. Dubois will never risk the flaring public scandal of an attack on the Asclepia, and by tomorrow I shall have raised such a noise that private murder will be out of the question. Call a chaise and wear a veil. There is no danger, but it would be as well for you not to be seen. Is there any likelihood of the people of the hotel coming to clean the room?"
"No. Johnson always insists upon his own house slaves doing everything. But if you like, you could go into his rooms. They do not open onto the corridor, and we have the only keys, there on the table."
She bent down, kissed him, and hurried out of the room. He heard her order the carriage. Was it more than two posts to Salem? And in less time than he had ever known a woman take to dress, she was back in a travelling habit and a broad-brimmed, veiled hat. They embraced. He said,
"I never doubted your courage, my dear. Tell the man to drive slow in this wicked fog. God bless."
She said, "I will lock you in."
And she was gone. He walked into the big drawing-room next door, unshuttered, and by contrast fairly light. The fog had thinned a little more, and standing on a chair he could see the dim form of her chaise move out into the roadway, turn to the right and right again, down the side street he had so lately traversed, towards Mr. Andrews's house. If he were there, she would be back in 20 minutes. If not, then in perhaps 2 hours or 3. She had all the spirit in the world, all the courage for this kind of thing, for a physical emergency. Guts, as the seaman said. It was impossible not to admire her. Impossible not to like her. A French clock on the mantelshelf struck 11. Twice. He sat down, and while deep within himself he went on musing about Diana, his medical side, his medical hands moved about his painful ribs, his far more painful head. He felt curiously exhausted, and his mind did not focus well, but moved vaguely round and round the central point. The physician was in better shape, stating that the 8th and 9th ribs were probably cracked, no more, but that there was something very like a crepitation along the coronal suture, a little above the temporal crest, while the main seat of pain was on the other side, a clear contre-coup effect.
"I wonder that there was no concussion," he observed, "but no doubt nausea will ensue."
This was all the physician had to say, since there was no remedy but rest, and Stephen's thoughts returned wholly to Diana. A glance at the clock showed him that she must by now have got on to the Andrews's cottage, and he pictured her haranguing the anxious, worried little man. The half-hour roused him to a sense of his duty. He returned to the bedroom, picked up the keys, and passed through the long suite of rooms to Johnson's private quarters, unlocking and relocking the doors as he went. The last true room was evidently his closet, with a large roll-top desk, a strong-box, and a quantity of files and papers. A door in the far corner led to a privy, which also contained a hip-bath. It was just as well, because at this point the nausea that he had foreseen came on, and he knelt there, vomiting for a while. Recovered now, and washed, he walked back into the study. The difficulty was to know where to start. On the scientist's principle of dealing with the easiest first, he went through the open files and papers. Most were the private records and accounts of a very wealthy man, but there were some interesting French documents with translations in Diana's dashing hand. These dated back to before the war. The more recent were in hands he did not recognize, except for Louisa Wogan's. Even so, Diana would possess useful knowledge about the background of the French connection. Memoranda about the military position on the Great Lakes and the Canadian land frontier. A coded list, presumably of agents there. A note about himself. Pontet-Canet confirms that Mathurin has an inclination to retire to the States. A grant of land in a district of unusual interest to a naturalist might swing the scale. More accounts and official correspondence, lists of prisoners with remarks and interrogations, nothing of the first importance but useful material among the dross. He turned his attention to the desk. None of the keys fitted it, which was significant, but roll-top desks in general presented no great difficulty to one who was used to these things, and once Stephen had found which of the ornamental knobs controlled the back bar, one firm thrust of his catling released the bolt and the top rolled back. The first thing he saw was the blaze of Diana's Riviere in its open case, blazing even in this pale, ghostly light, and beside it, under the heavy obsidian phallus that acted as a paperweight, a letter addressed to himself. The seal had been raised, and he was not the first to read.
"Dearest Stephen, I heard you talking, and I expected you, but I saw you go away without coming to me. Oh, what can it mean? Have I vexed you? I did not give you a clear answer. We were interrupted, and perhaps you thought I refused your offer. But I did not, Stephen. I will marry you whenever you wish, and oh, so gladly. You do me too much honour, Stephen, dear. I should never have refused you in India. It went against my heart. But now, such as I am, alas, I am entirely yours, Diana. P.S. That gross fellow is taking his trollop into the country. Come and see me. We shall have all Sunday together. Remember me to Cousin Jack."
He had barely grasped the full implication of this before he heard a sound at the door, a slight metallic grating at the lock. It was certainly not Diana. He seized the paperweight, silently closed the desk, and stepped behind the opening door. It was Pontet-Canet, on the same errand as himself. The Frenchman obviously knew the place, and he was better equipped than Stephen. He selected one of the many skeleton keys on his ring and opened the strongbox, took out a book, and carried it to the desk. His practiced hand went straight to the master knob, the top rolled back, and he sat down to copy from the book. He moved the diamond necklace to make room for the paper he brought from his pocket, and in doing so he saw the letter.
"Oh, oh, la garce!" he whispered as he read it. "Oh, la garce!"
Stephen had his pistol ready, but although this was an inside room, enclosed, he wished to avoid the noise. Pontet-Canet stiffened, uneasy, raising his head as though he felt the threat. Stephen strode forward, and as the Frenchman turned, he brought the massive obsidian down on his head, breaking both. Pontet-Canet was on the floor, limp but breathing. Stephen bent over him, catling in hand, felt for the still-beating common carotid, severed it, and stood back from the jet of blood. Then he pulled the body to the hip bath, placed towels and mats to prevent the blood soaking through to the floor below, and went through the dead man's pockets. Nothing of significance, but he did take Pontet-Canet's pistol, and since he did not possess one, his watch, a handsome Breguet, very like that which had been taken from him years ago, when he was captured by the French off the coast of Spain. Changing the bloody chair for another, he sat down to the open book. Memoranda of Johnson's conversations with Dubois, copies of his letters to his political chief, day-by-day transactions, future projects, uncoded, perfectly frank. No wonder Pontet-Canet had gone straight to it. With this book before him, he had his ally's secret mind wide open, without the last reserve. On the most recent page, after a complaint about the Frenchman's attack on Dr. Mathurin, Johnson had written, "I shall have a further interview with him on Monday, when I propose to bring greater pressure to bear. If, however, he should still prove obdurate, I believe he must be discreetly resigned to Dubroy in exchange for a free hand with Lambert and Brown, preferably in a place where this will excite no public comment. I have already repatriated virtually all the fit prisoners to prevent any unpleasant incident."
Had Johnson written this before or after he had read Diana's letter?
If before, had he then given Dubroy leave to go ahead, or had the Frenchman, fearing that Stephen would yield on Monday, decided to confront Johnson with a fait accompli once again? They were interesting points, but purely academic at this stage. He returned to the study of the book. It was easier to read now, the midday sun having partially dispersed the fog, and with the greater light the town had woken up. The noise of traffic in the street had reached something near its usual pitch, and someone at no great distance was letting off fireworks. Was this perhaps a holiday? Another American victory at sea? The pain in his head was growing, and in spite of the greater light his eyes would not keep their focus long. Lost in his reading, and his conjectures, and his pain, he did not perceive the opening of the door that Pontécanet had left unlocked until it was already on the jar.
"Tu es là, Jean-Paul?" whispered Dubreuil.
No choice this time. No question of silence now. Stephen rose, whipping round with a pistol already in his hand, thrust it against Dubreuil's recoiling chest, and fired. The man jerked back against the edge of the open door, and as it slowly yielded, so he fell. The expression of amazement and malignity lasting until his head was quite down, dull and indifferent at last. Stephen stood with the smoking pistol in his hand, listening to the immense report that seemed to fill the room and his head so lastingly. The smell of powder and scorched cloth. Slow, slow. The minutes passed. Yet no one seemed to have heard the shot. No running feet, no hammering on the outer doors, no sound at all but for the clock striking the quarter, and outside some kind of a procession was passing the hotel, remote cheers, laughter, a squib or two. The tension diminished to a tolerable pitch. He put the pistol down and dragged Dubreuil to the privy, to the hip bath. "This is like the end of Titus Andronicus," he said, with an affectation of callous brutality, as he heaved the body in. But he was, he found, seriously disturbed, and he wondered why. He had not even searched Dubreuil. Why not? Corpses he had seen by the score, even by the hundred, in open and clandestine battle, yet this killing sickened him. It was unreasonable. He had had to kill or be killed, and Dubreuil was the man who misused Carrington and Vargas so inhumanly until they died. Yet there it was, and he found that he could do no more than read mechanically, scarcely retaining anything of significance. The squalor of his own conduct and of his enemies, all for the best of motives. The extreme violence of this morning, the physical and perhaps moral exhaustion, were obvious causes for his state, yet it was strange that he could not master his thinking mind and compel it to answer the question, what was he to do next? He posed the question again and again, and the only answer was that it was impossible to leave the hotel with a Frenchman waiting in the hall, that he must nevertheless get these documents and Diana clear, and that the Asclepia could be no sort of refuge once Johnson was back. A string of negatives, no more. He heard Diana return. She was talking, and for a moment he thought it must be Johnson, back before his time, perhaps warned by the traitor Peg. But then he realized that the other voice was Herapath's. He went towards her, door after door, and she met him in the dining room. Her face was anxious and downcast, and as soon as she saw him, she said, "I'm so sorry, so very sorry, Stephen, darling, but Andrews was not there. He has gone back to Halifax in the cartel, with nearly all the prisoners of war." "Never mind it, my dear," said Stephen gently. He felt an immense pity for her. He could hardly tell why. "Herapath is with you?" "In the drawing room." "Were there any Frenchmen in the hall?" "Yes, quite a crowd, laughing and talking, some in uniform, but neither Pontécanet nor Dubreuil." They walked into the drawing room. Herapath greeted Stephen with a look of deep concern, but Stephen only gave him a vague "how do you do," and said he must write a note. "There is a writing table in my room," said Diana, opening the door and pointing. He stared stupidly at the paper for some moments and then wrote, "Jack, I have been obliged to kill two Frenchmen here. There are other Frenchmen below, and I cannot get out. They tried to kill me this morning. I must get Diana out of here at any cost at all, and some papers and myself, if it can be done. Wogan will not do. Do not tell Herapath this, nor the Asclepia. Choate might find Diana a refuge, or Father Costello, who is to marry me. I am not myself. Jack, do what you can. The big porter might prove a friend." "Mr. Herapath," he said, coming back, "might I beg you to give this to Captain Aubrey as soon as ever you can reach him?
"'It is of the very last importance to me, or I should not trouble you.'
"'With all my heart,' said Herapath.
They were alone, and Diana moved about the room, lighting candles, drawing curtains. She looked at him from time to time and said,
"'My God, Stephen, I have never seen you look so down, or low, or such a wretched colour. Have you had anything to eat today?'
"'Not a thing,' he said, trying to smile.
"'I shall order a meal at once, and while it is coming, lie on my bed and have a drink. You look as if you could do with it. I shall have one, too.'
He did as he was told. His head was furiously painful now, but he said, "'No food.'
"'You do not like to see me drinking, do you?'
she said, pouring out the bourbon.
"'No,' said he. "'You are a fool to your complexion, Villiers.
Is whiskey bad for it?'
"'Spirits harden tissues, sure. That is a fact.'
"'I only drink any when I am excited, as I am now, or when I am low. Still, as I have been low ever since I came here, I dare say I must have swallowed gallons. But I will not be low with you, Stephen.'
A long silence, and she went on.
"'Do you remember, years and years ago, you asked me whether I had read Chaucer, and I said, "'Filthy old Chaucer,' and you abused me for it. Well, at least he did say, "'In woman, venolent is no defence. Thus knoweth lechers by experience.'
"'Diana,' he said abruptly, "'do you know anyone in America? Have you any sure friend that you can trust, that you can run to?'
"'No,' she said, surprised. "'Not a single soul. How could I, in my position? Why do you ask?'
"'You were so kind as to write me a letter yesterday. A very, very kind letter.
Yes?
It never reached me. I found it on Johnson's desk, next to your diamonds.
Oh, my God,
she said, quite deadly pale.
Clearly we must be away before he returns, said Stephen. I have sent to Jack to see what he can do. If he can do nothing, why, there are other possibilities.
Maybe there were, but what were they? Apart from a wild flight in the dark. His mind could not, or would not, grapple with a problem hard and tight. Clear, prolonged, incisive thought was beyond his power.
"'I don't care,' she said, taking his hand. "'I don't mind, so long as you are there.'
Chapter 8
"'Captain Aubrey, if you please,' said Michael Herapath.
"'What name?' asked the porter.
"'Herapath.'
"'You are not Mr. Herapath?'
Looking into those black, implacable eyes, Herapath replied, "'I'm George Herapath's son. I brought the captain a message from Dr. Maturin.'
"'I will take it up. No visitors are allowed.' Shortly afterwards he reappeared with a nurse, and said in a more human tone, "'Ascend. Miss will show you the way.' "'Mr. Herapath!' cried Jack, holding out his hand. "'I am heartily glad to see you!' And when the door had closed, "'Come, sit close by my bed. Is the doctor hurt?'
"'Not that I could see, sir, but he was strangely slow. Dazed, I might say.'
"'Did you see any Frenchmen as you came away from the hotel?'
"'Yes, sir. It is their general rendezvous, and there were 8 or 9 of them sitting about the lobby, soldiers and civilians.'
His former captain had always been a formidable figure to Michael Herapath. He was still more so now as he sat straight up in his bed, looking larger and broader and more angry than ever he had done aboard the Leopard. And when, after a dark, brooding pause, he said in that strong, decided voice of his,
"'Reach me my shirt and breeches, will you?'
Herapath did so without protest. He did cry out, however, when Jack plucked off his sling and thrust his injured arm into the sleeve.
"'Surely, sir, Dr. Maturin would never allow—'
The only reply was,
"'My coat and shoes are in that tall locker, Mr. Herapath. Is your father at home?'
"'Yes, sir.'
"'Then be so good as to give me an arm down the stairs and show me the way to his house. God damn and blast this buckle!'
Herapath knelt to fasten it, reached Jack his pistol, and helped him down the stairs.
"'Not, as Jack observed, that I am not spry enough, but when you have been laid up a while, sometimes you're unsteady when it comes to a flight of steps, and I would not stumble now, by God!'
But in the hall the porter stopped them.
"'You are not allowed out,'
he said, his hand on the lever that controlled the door. Jack compelled his face to assume what amiability it could, and he said,
"'I'm only going to take a turn, to see Dr. Maturin.'
his left hand clenched round the barrel of his pistol, and he measured the force of the blow he should have to give to disable such a powerful man.
"The doctor is in some trouble," he added, remembering Stephen's note.
The Indian opened the door.
"If he needs me," he said without any change of expression, "I am his man. I'm free in half an hour. Less, if necessary."
Jack shook his hand, and they walked out into the fog, as thick now as it had been in the morning.
"You know, those damned French dogs set upon him this morning. They mean to kill him if they can. It is like attacking a ship in a neutral port. God rot there!"
The rest of his words were lost in a deep growl of blasphemy. Yet on the surface, he was calm enough by the time they reached the house. He asked Herapath to go in first and tell his father he wished to see him alone, and when he was shown into the study he found the big man there, looking concerned, surprised, but welcoming.
"I'm delighted to see you in my house, Captain Aubrey," he said. "Pray sit down and take a glass of port. I do hope and trust that this is not imprudent in such a fog with your—" "Mr. Herapath, sir," said Jack, "I'm come to your house because you are a man I trust and esteem. I'm come to ask you a service, and I know that if you cannot do it, if you must decline, you will not blab."
"You do me honour, sir," said Herapath, looking at him hard,
"and I am obliged to you for your confidence. Please to name the service. If it is a matter of discounting a bill, even an important bill, set your mind at rest." "You are very good, but it is far more than any bill that I could draw."
Herapath looked grave. Jack considered for a moment and said,
"You showed me two fine barks of yours, Mr. Herapath, tied up not far from the Asclepia. Now, when they were sailing, before this accursed war, I dare say your masters did not care to have all their best hands impressed. I dare say they had their hiding holes."
"That may be so," said Herapath, his head cocked to one side.
"And knowing you, sir, I dare say they were about the best hiding holes that could be devised."
Herapath smiled.
"Now I will not beat about the bush. I will tell you straight out. My friend Maturin is beset by a gang of Frenchmen who mean to kill him. He's gone to ground at Franchon's hotel, and he cannot stir. I mean to get him out, and with your leave, I mean to hide him in one of your barks."
He saw agreement and relief flood over Herapath's enormous, purplish face.
"But that is not all. I must be quite open and candid with you. He has also knocked a couple of them on the head. The others do not know it yet, I am sure, but it cannot be long concealed. He also wishes to take an English lady with him, a cousin of my wife's, to whom he is contracted in marriage, Mrs. Villiers."
"Dr. Maturin is to marry Mrs. Villiers, and take her away with him?"
cried Herapath, perfectly aware that if Diana were to vanish, Louisa Wogan would take her place, that Louisa was at present in the country with Johnson, and that Johnson would wish to have no part of his Caroline.
"Yes, sir. And what is more, Mr. Herapath, what is more, I wish to go with them myself, to try to get them clear in a boat, when tide and weather serve, if you can let me have one. For you will observe, sir, that I have not given my parole. I am not a prisoner, on parole. A dory would do. Stephen Maturin is a very learned man, but I would not trust him to cross a horse pond in any kind of craft whatsoever, and I must go with him. There, sir. I have given you a plain, straightforward account, and upon my honour I do not believe I have misrepresented anything, nor concealed any risk."
"I am sure you have not," said Herapath,
walking up and down with his hands behind his back.
"I have a great respect for Dr. Maturin. I am amazed at what you tell me."
"Do you wish to consider on it for a while?"
"No, no, I am only slow in answering, because I cannot make up my mind which is best of Orion or Arcturus. The hiding holes, I mean. A lady and two gentlemen. Arcturus it must be. So much more space. I have a fool of a shipkeeper aboard, that's of no consequence. But tell me, sir, how do you propose to get him out?"
"I thought of reconnoitering the place, back stairs, stables, servants' quarters, and so on, before making any plan. All I know of the position is what your son has told me, and what I learnt from Maturin's brief note. I know that he is in Mrs. Villiers' rooms. Your son saw him there. But I do not know the nature of the terrain at all."
"Let us have the boy in," said Herapath. "Michael, whereabouts in Franchon's are Mrs. Villiers' rooms?"
"They're on the first floor, sir, in front, giving on to the long balcony."
"The balcony?" said Jack.
A light grapnel and a line could answer very well on balconies, but there were other things to consider first.
"Tell me, did the Frenchmen below seem concerned, agitated, upset? Were they armed, busy with the people of the hotel, or with officials?"
"Not at all, sir," said young Herapath.
They were laughing and talking as though they were in a cafe or a club. As for arms, the officers had their swords, but I saw no others. Jack asked him to draw a plan of the hotel. A slow, unsatisfactory performance, as young Hedipath had no gift that way, nor any visual memory. From time to time, his father, who knew the hotel intimately, added a corridor or a flight of stairs. But after a while he left them to it, while he paced up and down, or stared out of the window at the fog.
"I have it!" he cried at last, interrupting them. "I have it! It has come to me! The buck, basket, and burnt cork. Dr. Maturin don't weigh above 9 stone. Captain Aubrey, my shipkeeper in the Arcturus, is a black man. Let us cork your face and hands, so that you can take his place. I shall send him off to Salem or Marblehead, and no one will notice the odds or think tuppence of it if they do." "Othello!" he cried.
His face was lit up, bright red with excitement and a kind of wild prospective triumph. His eyes, from oyster-like, had grown sparkling and young. Too young, perhaps, thought Jack and his son, looking at him with astonishment. Too young and even drunk. Yet not a glass had been poured from the decanter. His hand and step were ready, if not his voice.
"Othello! And you've already smoked my Falstaff, sir, I'm sure." "Ha, ha! We shall confound the Frenchmen yet! God damn their knavish tricks! I have the greatest respect for Dr. Maturin."
"I am not wholly with you, sir," said Jack.
"Why, Falstaff and the buck basket, don't you recall? They took him out in a buck basket in the play, though he weighed 5 times the doctor. We have just such a basket. Huge! Michael, run and ask your aunt where the huge basket is. God love me," he said, "I feel like a young man again. We carry him out under their poxed French noses. From her acquaintance with Mr. Johnson, I take it the lady is in no danger. I beg pardon if I'm indiscreet."
"I believe she can walk in and out just as she pleases," said Jack, "at least until Johnson returns, and I understand he is engaged tonight."
They understood one another. They understood the nature of Johnson's engagement, and they looked oddly false when Michael Hedipath came back. The basket could not be touched. It was in the laundry, full of dirty clothes.
"Toss them out, and bring it here," said Mr. Hedipath. "No, first tell Abednego I want the coach. I shall drive myself, and then run down to the Arcturus and send Joe to Salem. Give him some urgent message to John Quincy to be taken at once. See him out of the ship and take his set of keys. Tell him to go aboard the Spiker and stay there till I send for him. There, sir, what do you think of my plan? Plain, simple, straightforward, eh? But then I am a plain man myself, and like things simple and straightforward, much as you do yourself, I believe."
"A very pretty plan indeed, sir," said Jack, "and it has great advantages. A great deal to be said for it. But you will give me leave to alter it on a view of the terrain, if some new point arises. I have some notion that the balcony may serve, and perhaps we should be well advised to take a grapnel and, say, 10 fathoms of stout line."
"By all means, though I doubt you see your balcony at all, it is coming on so thick. Why, now I can barely make out my neighbour Dawson's light from here, though 1/2 hour ago it was quite sharp and clear. The only thing that worries me is my blacks to carry the basket."
"Do they have to be black men?"
"No, but it would seem more natural, pass unnoticed."
"If I were blacked, as you suggest, I would do for one.
But your arm, my dear sir, your arm, and your general state of health."
"My left arm has never been better, and it is certainly strong enough to carry a 1/2 Maturin. Look."
He gazed about for some heavy object, pitched upon a tall marble stand, and raised it high.
"And yet, sir,"
he went on,
"upon reflection, I believe we must first reconnoitre. A cutting-out expedition without you know the harbour and the tides is often a sad waste of life. Do by all means send your shipkeeper away, and until your son comes back we can weigh our measures, take counsel, and consider."
"Very well. Michael, take the little mare."
The interval was of no great length, and Mr. Hedipath filled it by drawing a better plan of the hotel, fetching the basket, several corks, some line, and a pot-hook that would serve as a grapnel. He loaded a blunderbuss and 3 horse pistols, double-charged and double-shotted. He was excited as a boy, and it was clear that he wished to be doing right away. He did not like the notion of a mere reconnaissance, but hoped to carry out the coup de main, as he often called it, in a single operation. His mind was much set on his 2nd negro, and at one time Jack thought of the Indian porter. But how far was the man to be relied upon? There would be questions, and many of them, when the dead Frenchmen were discovered, and Jack had no wish for them to be discovered, all three, in the hiding hole aboard Arcturus. Nor did he want Herapath to put his head into a noose.
"There is another small point to be considered," he said, "and that is the provision of someone to hold the horses, unless you stay on the box."
"Oh, as for that," said Herapath, "any blackguard boy will do. There are always blackguard boys hanging around the hotel to hold horses' heads."
"Yes," said Jack. "But will not your blackguard boy recognize Mr. Herapath?"
"Oh," said Mr. Herapath. "Oh, yes, indeed. I'd best stay on the box, muffled up."
Jack looked at his face.
"I had better not press that point," he reflected. And he said, "Might I trouble you for a civilian coat, Mr. Herapath? Epaulettes are tolerably conspicuous, even on a foggy night."
He was indeed a conspicuous figure in a post-captain's uniform, complete but for his surrendered sword.
"Perhaps a serving man's coat or a frock might be best, and a common round hat if you have one at hand."
"You think of everything," said Herapath, and he hurried off.
His enthusiasm, momentarily damped, blazed up again as he reclothed Jack in a choice of different coats, settling for a worn, sad-coloured gabardine.
"But we shall have to have your hair off, my dear sir, before we turn you into a convincing nigger."
Jack's hair was long and yellow, and he wore it clubbed, tied with a black ribbon between his shoulder blades.
"I shall fetch scissors. And now I come to think of it, walnut juice would be far better than burnt cork. You would not object to walnut juice, Captain Aubrey?"
"Never in life," said Jack. "Once we have surveyed the field, and once we have fixed upon our plan, you shall dye me from head to foot, and clip my hair off too, if you wish."
They fell silent, listening for Michael's return. Herapath fiddled with his buck basket, blunderbuss, and the cordage, fetched one dark lantern and two plain, and a basket of provisions for the hiding hole. Jack studied the plan. He did not regret his step, it was the only move open to him, but he did regret old Herapath's zeal. He was by no means sure how the old gentleman would behave when the expedition turned from something like play to earnest, perhaps very bloody earnest, and he much regretted the earliness of the hour. For such an operation, the later the time and the fewer people about, the better, and keeping Herapath easy was going to be a task. Nor did he see the necessity for negroes. The natural carriers were the hotel's men.
"Here he is," said Herapath,
and a moment later his son walked in.
"Is all well, Michael?" he asked.
"Yes, sir. Joe is on his way to Salem in Gooch's cart, and the coach is ready in the yard. I've sent Abednego to bed."
"Good boy. Now let us load these things aboard. They can all go into the buck basket. Take care of the blunderbuss. Make haste, make haste. Now, sir, this way, if you please."
"First," said Jack deliberately, "I will ask you to drive me to the bark. It is a cardinal rule of tactics to ensure one's line of retreat."
His tone was so convinced, so authoritative, that Mr. Herapath made no objection, although he did look a little discontented. He climbed onto the box. They rolled out of the stable yard, and at once it became apparent to Jack that Mr. Herapath was no great coachman. They gave the rounded stone at the corner into the street a long, grinding scrape, and the driver's excitement communicating itself to the horses, the coach soon began to bound and rattle over the indifferent paving at such a pace, in spite of the fog, that those inside had to cling on, while Mr. Herapath kept up a steady,
"Hey now, Roger! Easy, Bess! Easy, Rob! Hey there!"
They very nearly crushed two drunken soldiers, and they drove one gig fairly onto the sidewalk, but happily there was little other traffic in the streets, and the horses sobered as they neared the harbour. Herapath drove to his usual tavern, or rather the horses took him there, and they walked along the quays to the Arcturus, carrying a lantern and the basket of provisions.
"Now, sir," said Mr. Herapath, leading them below, "I shall show you something that I reckon will surprise you."
Below, with the smell of tar and cordage and bilge water, aft to the bread room, and there they stood. The space, now empty, was entirely lined with sheet metal, tinned against the rats, and it still smelt of biscuit. Mr. Herapath pressed the wooden slats that held these sheets, jerked them, and sounded the panels, all of which gave the same hollow boom.
"Where is it?"
he muttered.
"Damn my eyes! I could have sworn... seen it 100 times!
"I believe it is this one, sir," said his son, causing a slat to pivot.
The metal sheet opened upwards on a hinge, showing a space where four or five hands could lie hidden while the ship was being searched.
"There! Look at that!" cried Mr. Herapath. "I said I should amaze you!"
Both father and son were so pleased that Jack had not the heart to say he had seen the device half a dozen times at least when, as a midshipman or lieutenant, he had been sent aboard merchantmen to press what men he could. But his sinking spirits rose a little when he reflected that it would baffle landlubbers, and that although officers of the Royal Navy might find it easily enough, those of the American Navy had no practice in this sort of detection, since they never pressed men at any time, their crews being made up of picked volunteers. Yet on the other hand, many and many an American seaman had been hidden from impressment, either in barrels, in the hold, or in places of this kind, and many an American officer had commanded merchantmen. Mr. Herapath showed him the catch inside that released the flap, stowed away the basket, and gave him the spare set of keys.
"Now, sir," he said, looking at his watch by the light of the lantern, "now for our reconnaissance. It is growing late."
It had grown later still by the time the coach reached the hotel. The first scrape of their setting out had injured the offside trace, and it parted altogether when Mr. Herapath involved the horses with a stationary hand-barrow on the way up from the harbour. The rope they had with them answered well enough, but it was a long, slow task. The ordinary lanterns took to going out, and they had to be relit inside the coach, while the dark lantern shed but a feeble gleam, and the restive horses gave trouble from the beginning to the very end. The accident happened on the corner of Washington Street, and although most of Boston was in bed, at one time a small knot of people gathered to give advice, and two of them addressed Mr. Herapath by name. In the first stages of the repair he was talkative, full of suggestions, eager to be done and off. By the time Jack had whipped and served the trace, with a stout preventer from the swingle aft, he had grown much quieter, though there was a tendency to find fault and take offence, and when at last they drove towards the hotel he was almost mute. Jack knew the symptoms well. He had seen them often enough during the long pull towards a hostile shore before the batteries opened fire. Young Herapath, on the other hand, was calm, steady, apparently unmoved. He bore his father's reproaches with admirable patience. It was late. Too late for any blackguard boys to hold the horses' heads. So late that there was little sign of life in the hotel, apart from singing in the bar.
Malbrook, s'en va-t en guerre, Mironton, Mironton, Mirontin,
and lights in the hall. Jack lowered the glass and stared intently at the façade. A northwest breeze had sprung up while they were mending the trace, and although the fog was still quite thick, between the drifting swathes he saw the lines of balcony across the front of the hotel. The coach came to a stop, not quite outside the door, but a little lower down the street. Jack stepped out and said to Michael Herapath,
"You go in. See how the land lies. Tell them we are here, and report back. You are all right, Herapath, are you not?"
"Yes, sir," said young Herapath.
He went back along the sidewalk and into the hotel, and as the door opened, light came out into the wispy fog, and the singing grew louder.
"Malbrook, ne reviens plus!"
Jack walked along by the horses. The offside leader was particularly restless and troublesome. The whole team seemed apprehensive and nervous, and a cat crossing the street with a kitten in her mouth set them all capering. And from there he studied the hotel. His eye at once caught the workmen's pulley and its dangling rope. Great possibilities there. Two men walked by, and he busied himself with the trace as they glanced at the coach. Mr. Herapath plucked his coat collar round his face and pulled his hat still further down. A third, walking briskly, muttering to himself. Mr. Evans of the Constitution and a colleague, deep in conversation. One black woman with a large, flat-covered basket on her head. Mr. Herapath found his tongue again, and talking half to himself, half to Jack, as he stood near the step of the box, he kept up a continuous low stream of words.
"How long he is! I could have done it in half the time. Always the same, dilly-dally, dilly-dally. We should have started far earlier, as I said. Hush! There's a man crossing the street. I'm not as young as I was, Captain Aubrey. These things are all very well for young men. How long he is, the goddamned fool of a boy! Ain't it cold? My feet are like blocks of ice. You know, Captain Aubrey, I'm a prominent citizen, a member of the town meeting. Anyone may recognize me. That was Reverend Chorley. It would be much wiser for me to sit inside the coach. if you will come up on the box.
So I will, said Jack. But first I shall just step along to the corner, so see what the angle gives.
His mind was running fast and clear. That singing indoors did not speak of any state of siege, nor of an ambush. The balcony might prove a gift of God. Even with his injured arm, it was swelling most unpleasantly, and it had little strength, but still it would get him up. He had that fine, contained feeling of going into action, heart beating high but well in hand, and the freshening breeze on his cheek as he stared up at Diana's shuttered window strengthened the impression, yet he kept his fingers crossed. Behind the shutter, sitting by a pair of candles burnt almost to the sockets as Stephen read in Johnson's book, they heard a knock.
"Oh, my God! It's Johnson!"
whispered Diana. The knock again, and she called out in a high, sharp voice,
"What is it?"
"Mr. Michael asks if Mrs. Villiers can receive him,"
said the ancient voice of the hotel porter, almost the only person still on duty.
"Yes, yes. Ask him to come up."
Minutes. The minutes drew out, unnaturally long, and at last he was there.
"I'm sorry to have been so long," he said. "I stood to watch the last French officers leave. They're just by the door, arguing and laughing. One at least is drunk. In a few minutes we may go. Captain Aubrey and my father are below with the coach. I will go on to the landing, see them out, and tell you."
"We shall be ready," said Stephen, springing up. "Diana, pack some clothes."
He hurried back to Johnson's room, made a quick, accurate selection of papers. By the wavering light of his candle, Dubreuil's waxy face, white in the open privy door, seemed to move, losing the awful gravity of death, returned and sat with them on his knee, a heavy pile.
"Stephen,"
whispered Diana,
"you said my diamonds were in Johnson's desk. Is it open, then?"
"It is, but do not go in there, Diana. You would see a very ugly sight."
"Bah," she said, "I do not give a damn. They are mine. I have earned them."
She came back, carrying the jewel case, and her footsteps left a diminishing trail of blood.
"I mean," she said, "by receiving his horrible political guests and translating—"
He looked down. The Diana he had known could never have said the first words, or having, by some impossibility, said them, she would never, never have produced the explanation. She was obscurely aware of this. She said,
"I did not know you had anything to do with spying, Maturin."
"No more I have," he replied, "but I know the army intelligence officer in Halifax, and these papers may be useful to him."
Herapath put his head through the door.
"They're going out," he said. "They're in the outer lobby. Let us walk down."
He took Diana's small trunk, and they went slowly down the stairs into the empty hall. The old porter was moving away from them, putting out the lights in the bar. At the same time, the Frenchman, moved by some freak, burst out into the street with a concerted whoop, waving their hats. The coach instantly surged into motion. It was already going fast by the time it passed Jack on the corner. The Frenchman hallooed, running past him after the coach for a little way, and then, still calling out and laughing, they faded into the fog. The horses could be heard breaking from a trot to a gallop. Jack turned, saw his friends come out and stand, an uncertain group, looking right and left. He joined them as the light went out in the hall, and leading them round the corner, he said,
"The horses bolted. Are there any Frenchmen left?"
"No, sir," said Herapath.
"Cousin Diana, your servant. Stephen, how are you? Not hurt? Give me your bundle. Herapath, I am most uncommon obliged to you, by God I am. Can you show us the way down to the harbour?"
"The quietest way is by this lane," said Herapath. "It leads by my house. Will you step in and rest, or take some refreshment?"
"No, I thank you," said Jack. "The sooner aboard the better. But we must not hurry. We must walk, naturally."
Their steps echoed in the empty streets, and as they went, the moon came through, faint at first, and then quite clear as the fog fled with the breeze, until she showed most of the time, gibbous, hunched, sailing away northwest among the higher clouds, and shedding her spectral light. A few cats, a sleeping hog, and from the back of Herapath's low and squalid house, the fretful crying of a child.
"That is Caroline," he said.
He went in. The crying stopped. Sometime later he came out with a lantern, and by its light Stephen inspected Jack's wounded arm, bound it up and slung it with his neckcloth,
taking the books and papers from him without a word. In 5 minutes they were on the deserted moonlit quay, walking along by the ships, which creaked and groaned as they rocked on the rising tide. Herapath led them aboard the Arcturus, below, and to the bread room. He opened the metal flap, and after a slight hesitation Diana climbed in, followed by Stephen. Neither had said more than a few words since leaving the hotel, and indeed the tension had mounted steadily from that point onwards.
"There is a basket in there behind you," said Herapath, still speaking very quietly. "I will bring you some more food tomorrow."
Diana spoke up, and spoke handsomely. She thanked Mr. Herapath extremely, more than she could say for this evening. She could not tell him how she admired his coolness. She begged he would kiss that dear child Caroline for her, and she hoped she might see him again after he had had a good night's rest. No man had ever earned it better. And if it should cross his mind to bring a little milk, she would be so very grateful. Jack walked with him to the break of the quarter-deck, glanced at the sky, and said,
"Herapath, you have done nobly by us, nobly upon my honour. But we are not entirely out of the wood. There will be the devil's own hue and cry tomorrow, and I'm not quite happy about your father. Do not suppose that I mean to make the least reflection upon him. After such kindness, that would be a sad, shabby thing to do, base, contemptible. But he is an old gentleman, older than I had thought. And if they start to question him, what with the shock of tonight and the horses bolting, he might be led. You understand me?"
"Yes, sir."
"Now, we spoke of a boat, your father and I think it was before you came in, so that when time and tide allowed, I could get the doctor and Mrs. Villiers cleared away. But now it seems to me that this is the time, and the tide will suit the moment it has reached the full. On the other hand, your father is out of the way at this moment, and tomorrow may be too late. Can you find me one?"
"There is Joe's boat alongside, sir. But it's only an old sawn-down scow he goes fishing in. It would never face the open sea, nor even a blow in the harbour. You could never reach Halifax in it, I'm sure."
"Grant reached the Cape in the cutter, but I hope I shall not have to go so far. May we have a look at it?"
Herapath crossed the deck to the starboard rail, found a rope, and pulled. An ugly, slab-sided craft appeared from the gloom and ran alongside into the moonlight. A shrouded object lay fore and aft, and three cans gleamed in the moon like eyes.
"That must be his mast and sail," said Herapath, "and those are his bait-pots. I can smell them from here."
Jack looked long and hard.
"At high water," he said, "I shall go into her and run out on the ebb. Will you not come with us, Herapath? I will rate you midshipman in any ship I command, and you could be the doctor's assistant again. Things might be unpleasant for you in Boston."
"Oh, no, sir," said Herapath. "That would never do, though I am obliged to you for your care of me. I have ties here. And then, you know, we are enemies."
"By God, so we are. I had forgot. I find it difficult to think of you as an enemy, Herapath."
"Shall I give you a hand stepping the mast, sir? It would be awkward with your arm."
The mast was stepped. Young Herapath was gone. Jack stood there leaning on the rail, looking at the boat and out at the moonlit harbour, the vague looming of the islands and the powerful batteries. The tide flowed, perpetually mounting, the fenders strained and squeaked, and by imperceptible degrees the Arcturus's deck rose above the level of the quay. He kept a continual watch on the shifting currents, the swing of the small craft and their boys, the changing sky. The seaman was all alive. And all the time his ear was stretched, however illogically at this hour, for some clamour in the town, parties hurrying along the waterfront searching the ships. He also weighed a number of alternative courses of action if the breeze and his forecasts should fail. And beneath all this, his mind strayed far away. To England, and Sophie, of course, but also to Acasta, his promised command, and the possibility of a meeting that might set the balance more nearly right, and lift the black depression that had been with him ever since his first hour in the Java. Gilear, Macedonian, and Java. It was more than a man could bear. Before this, Stephen had called him a deeply superstitious man. Perhaps he was. He certainly had a strong belief in luck, as shown by various portents, some of them trivial enough, such as the presence of the star Arcturus overhead, and by a feeling impossible to define, though a particularly steady confidence formed part of it, that told him when the tide was in his favour. He felt it now. And although from a primitive piety he dared not let the words form, even in the remotest corner of his mind, he thought he should succeed. On the other hand, he felt there was bad luck with Diana, bad luck hanging about Diana. He did not wish to be below with her. She was unlucky, she brought bad luck. Although he was deeply grateful to her, and although he liked the way she had borne up so far, no mincing, no vapours, no complaints, for himself he wished her away. For Stephen he could not tell. He had seen him so tormented by her and for her these last years that he could no longer tell. Perhaps it was right that he should have her at last. In the dead silence of the middle watch, the graveyard watch, he believed he could just make out their voices far below. But the long silence was coming to an end. The first Monday morning wagons rumbled somewhere in the town, not a great way off, and far to the right he heard carts. The tide was very near the full. The flow had been diminishing this last half hour, and a small craft, there were a great many of them, pleasure boats, fishing boats, and some yachts, no longer strained at their buoys. The moon was only a hand's breadth from her setting.
"Joe!" came a voice from the darkness under the Arcturus's stern. "Joe, are yous a goin' out?"
"I ain't Joe," said Jack.
"Who are you, then?" asked the boat, now visible.
"Jack."
"Where's Joe?"
"Gone to Salem."
"Are yous a goin' out, Jack?"
"Maybe."
"You got any bait, Jack?"
"No."
"Well, fuck you, Jack!"
"And fuck you too, mate," said Jack mildly.
He watched the boat scull clear, hoist its sail, quietly swearing, and glide away on the slack water. Then he went below, groping along aft to the bread room. He saw light showing through the joints in the hinged sheet, tapped and heard Diana's low voice.
"Who is it?"
"Jack,"
he said, and the flap opened, showing Diana by the shielded lantern with a pistol in her lap. The atmosphere was stifling, and the flame quite low. She put her finger to her lips and said,
"Hush! He has eaten everything in the basket, and now he is fast asleep. He had had nothing all day. Can you imagine that?"
Some part of Jack's mind had also dwelt on breakfast, since his stomach had been calling out for some time, and he was conscious of a piercing disappointment.
"Well, he must wake up now. We are going into the boat. The tide is on the turn."
They tweaked and pulled him into a state of wakefulness and led him on deck, clutching his bundle. For a vessel of her size, the Arcturus had no great plank shear, but even so the dim boat was a long way down.
"Must we change ships?" he asked.
"I believe we must," said Jack.
"Would it not be better to wait for the tide to rise, and float the boat a little higher, a little nearer to the deck?"
"Their relative positions would remain the same, I do assure you. Besides, the tide is already at the full. Come, Stephen, you often jump down into a boat deeper than that."
"I'm thinking of Diana."
"Oh, Diana, she will skip down like a good 'un. You give her a hand over the side, and I will receive her in the boat. Diana, where is your chest? Stephen, clap onto this line, and lower away handsomely when I give the word."
He swung over the rail, dropped to the main chains, and with his left hand grasping a dead eye, he lowered himself into the boat.
"Lower away,"
he called, and the little trunk came down.
"Now, Diana."
He guided her feet onto the channel.
"Mind your petticoats and jump."
"Damn my petticoats," said Diana, and jumped.
He received her full pitch with his good arm.
"No one could call you a light woman, Diana," he said, setting her down among the bait pots and the pervading reek of decaying squid,
and then blushed in the darkness.
"Come on, Stephen,"
he called. There were wagons moving along the quay, and several lanterns. Voices out on the harbour, bobbing lights.
"Jack, have you a piece of string in your pocket? I cannot climb down without doing up my parcel." "Poor lamb," whispered Diana, "he is still half asleep."
She sprang up the side like a boy, took off her shawl, wrapped the papers in it, tied the corners, and tossed it into the boat.
"We shall get off some time, I suppose,"
said Jack, more or less to himself, shipping the rudder. And when at last they were down,
"Diana, stow yourself right forward and do not get in the way. Stephen, there are the rullocks. Pull right ahead. Give way!"
He shoved off. The Arcturus's side receded. Stephen made several effectual strokes.
"Boat your oars," said Jack. "Clap onto the halyard. No, the halyard! God's death! Haul away! Bear a hand, Stephen. Belay! Catch a couple of turns round the kevel. The kevel!"
The scow gave a violent lurch. Jack dropped all, scrambled forward, caught two turns round the kevel and slid back to the tiller. The sail filled. He brought the wind a little abaft the beam, and the scow headed out to sea.
"You are cursed snappish tonight, Jack," said Stephen. "How do you expect me to understand your altumal cant without pondering on it? I do not expect you to understand medical jargon without giving you time to consider the etymology, for all love."
"Not to know the odds between a halyard and a sheet after all these years at sea? It passes human understanding,"
said Jack.
"You are a reasonably civil, complacent creature on dry land," said Stephen. "But the moment you are afloat you become pragmatical and absolute, a bashaw. Do this, do that, glupit the prawling strangles there. No longer a social being at all. It is no doubt the effect of the long-continued habit of command, but it cannot be considered amiable."
Diana said nothing. She had a considerable experience, and she knew that if men were to be at all tolerable, they must be fed. She was also feeling the first premonitory qualms of seasickness. She was a very bad sailor, and she dreaded what was to come. The cut-down scow looked an awkward lump of a boat, but in point of fact, once Jack had grown used to its ways, he found that it behaved quite well, apart from its obstinate griping and its quite extraordinary leeway. Its bottom was perfectly flat, and it skidded sideways from the wind almost as fast and far as it travelled forward. There was plenty of sea-room, however, and as he had no need to fear shoal water in a craft that did not draw 6 inches, he set its head for Point Shirley in order to weather the Long Island. They were not alone in the vast outer harbour. Several other fishing boats had put out, and now, away to starboard in the deep water channel, lay the Chesapeake herself, just looming into view. There were lights in her cabin. Lawrence was already up, and as Jack gazed, the morning watch was called. More lights appeared in every scuttle and open half-port all along the berth deck, and over a mile of water he could hear the voices of the boatswain's mates, all the familiar din, so very like the ships he had served in. Indeed, the silence of the night was fading fast. Overhead the faint gulls were calling, and at the bottom of the bay Boston was waking up, lights showing the shape of the waterfront when he glanced astern. But they would not be needed long. Saturn had set, following the moon to rise in Tartary, and already there was a lightening in the east. On and on, steadily on, away from the land, the water rippling along the side, the sheet alive in his hand, the tiller under the crook of his knee. The breeze was nothing much, but with the help of the powerful ebb they were making 4 knots, or 5, with relation to the shore. And now he could feel the beginning of the true ocean, the heave of the open sea, though much attenuated here by reason of the Long Island.
"What's amiss?"
he asked suddenly.
"Diana is sick," said Stephen.
"Well, well, poor soul, let her lean out the leeward side."
The lightness ahead increased, and the Long Island was no longer a blur but a sharply outlined black mass, well within gunshot. Diana had collapsed in the bottom of the boat.
"It will have to be worse before it gets better,"
he reflected, glancing at her with a dispassionate eye. A string of gulls passed overhead, uttering their usual coarse, cynical laughter. Droppings fell aboard, and so they ran. The breeze was drawing ahead. At this rate of leeway he would probably have to tack to clear the point, and as it drew ahead, so it slackened. The rising sun might swallow it entirely. There was no breeze to be wasted.
"Lose not a minute," he said,
and tacking must lose many. Peering under the sail he watched the island shore coming closer, quite clear now, with people walking about on it and white water off the point. Closer and closer still. He let fly the sheet and grasped an oar, trusting to the strong tide run to carry them round. A couple of bumps, a rock, fended off, and it had done so. A man called out to them from the island. Jack waved, hauled in the sheet, and now they met the swell, setting from the southeast and cutting up against the ebb. At once the scow began a lumbering dance, and a renewed sound of dry retching came from the bows.
"Put my coat over her,"
said Jack, taking it off. An easy task, with his arm slung outside. Stephen had already covered her with his, but she shivered still, gritting her teeth and clenching her fists, shivered convulsively. Now there was Lovell's Island ahead, a cluster of fishing boats, blue sky beyond, and brilliant rays shooting up into it from the east. And now the blazing rim of the sun himself, bearable for a moment, and then too powerful by far. The breeze, grown fitful and capricious, suddenly backed right aft, a stronger gust that thrust the scow's head into a rising wave. Diana was soaked. She neither moved nor groaned, flat in the bows.